It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Ever since Donald Trump captured Pennsylvania in 2016 on his way to the presidency, Democrats have been on a bit of a roll in statewide elections, congressional races, and legislative contests. Joining us in studio is Nancy Patton Mills, chair of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. Nancy, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Okay, it's November 9th, 2016, the day after the presidential election. You were not state chair yet, but what was your mood? What was the mood of the Democratic Party at that time, the day after that election?
Well, a lot of people were very, very upset, and I went to work that night. Whenever I went to sleep, I knew that we had a lot of work to do. And as a matter of fact, the day after, on Thursday evening, I went to Chatham University on a panel. And, of course, when I had accepted that invitation, I thought we would have Hillary Clinton as our president. But I walked into that room, and the president of Chatham had mentioned to me that some of the younger women were upset the day after the election, had not gone to class. I knew we had a lot of work to do. I approached that panel, I think from an interesting standpoint. I asked them how many had been involved in the indivisible groups and volunteer groups for Hillary Clinton. The entire room raised their hands. And this was the public and students. So I knew that we had people who were going to continue the battle and continue the fight to bring Pennsylvania back into the blue column. So I went to work immediately.
Since that election, your party's had several victories, which I alluded to. Which do you think have been the most important to the party as a whole?
Well, I think that there were two things that happened that helped us. The first was the special election we had with Connor Lamb on April 13th last year. And Connor was a tremendous candidate, and we proved that day that if we had the right candidate for the district, that we could win. And we had three very, very red counties along with Allegheny County, and Connor Lamb won that. It was a narrow margin, but he did win it before redistricting took effect. So we knew that when the redistricting took effect, we would be able to have a level playing field all over Pennsylvania. The most important thing that happened for us was to take Pennsylvania, which had five Democratic congressional districts. So we had five districts identifying with the Democratic Party out of 18. So we now have nine. And I think that that gets us to 50-50. Mm-hmm. So we have 50% of the population of Pennsylvania now identifying as their congressperson is a Democrat.
Has the holding on to the governor's office, has that kept up the momentum? What about the chipping away of the Republican majorities in the state House and state Senate?
Well, I think this past election really told the tale of what's happening in Pennsylvania. Governor Wolf won by a larger margin than anybody has ever won. Our U.S. Senator Bob Casey, the same situation, two landslides. And there were coattails with those, but it was also a district-by-district win for us. We picked up 11 seats in the House and four in the Senate, and have since picked up another Senate seat here in western Pennsylvania with Pam Iovino in the 37th. That one is very interesting because since 1992, only 2 years have been Democratic in the 37th. And I'm very aware of that because it's my district. Okay. So I think that Pam Iovino, once again, was the right candidate for the district. And this is what we're doing all over Pennsylvania.
Of course, she won that special election to replace Guy Reschenthaler,
yes,
who gave up that seat when he was elected to Congress. Why do you think, well, do you think that those individual races, those contests, which are over, will they have any residual impact? Will they provide momentum into 2020? Why so?
Yes, I think because we have muscle memory. You know, it's an athletic event, and people are now comfortable voting Democratic in areas where they have always voted for a Republican. And I think that this will carry over not only into 2020. We're looking at 2019. So all over Pennsylvania, we have races we're going to be challenging that have always been Republican. And we're going to be challenging commissioner races, district attorneys, and other municipal races all over Pennsylvania.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is Nancy Patton Mills. She chairs the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. A moment ago, you mentioned that 50-50 split now on the Pennsylvania congressional delegation. What do you think affected those U.S. House races in 2018 here in Pennsylvania more? The newly drawn congressional district map, the Trump factor, Dems and Republicans more motivated to show up to whether it is to rebuke the president or show support for him? What do you think?
Well, I hate to say it's a little bit of everything that you mentioned, but it definitely is. I think that our congressional districts, the redistricting map, the new map, certainly helped us tremendously because it gave everybody who was running the opportunity to win. I think that's very, very important. We also were very, very careful how we picked our candidates and which candidates were elected in the primaries and which we knew which candidates would be able to win ultimately. Some of them were very tough races. We elected four women over in southeast Pennsylvania. And when those races began, we were looking at maybe two. And there were a couple that were going to be tougher than the other two. So they weren't just shoe-ins. They were races that needed to be, we had to give our point of view. We had to get our people out and get the vote out for our candidates. Now, when we look at the Trump factor, what has happened there is that this has motivated the Democratic base. A lot of people who took it for granted that Hillary Clinton was going to be the president did not vote. We know that. And so we have been able to motivate our Democratic base and encourage new Democrats to come to the table after the Trump election.
There used to be a formula for Democrats to win statewide contests, build up a big lead in the Philly area and the suburban counties, win Allegheny County comfortably and do pretty well in southwestern Pennsylvania, and then hold on. Is that still part of the equation or has it changed?
Well, I think it's changed. I have to explain that to people in Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh that they're not going to decide every race. And I think that it's really important to understand that we have 67 counties. And we have flipped a lot of seats all over this state. Yeah, a lot of areas where they were Republican before are now Democratic strongholds for us. I think that we're going to be seeing some interesting challenges coming up in the next election that are going to really, really see the change of Pennsylvania's Democratic landscape. South Central Pennsylvania is going to be challenged, a tremendous challenge for Congress. And we're really going to go after Mike Kelly up in Erie, too. I have two or three people that are looking at that race. And I think that we're going to be able to flip those two seats. And we have not given up on Friedenberg and District 12 in North Central Pennsylvania. That's the State College area. So if we can get out the vote there, I think that Friedenberg coming back to run for a seat that was vacated 2 days after it was taken, I think the voters are going to be, they have a little wake-up call that the Republicans elected Marino and he quit within 3 or 4 days of being sworn in. So I think that this is going to be an exciting race in North Central Pennsylvania also.
All right. So why do you think that an individual race might also be reflected in the statewide race where President Trump tries to hold on to Pennsylvania?
Well, we're challenging in all 67 counties. And some counties where they're strictly Republican and have been red are doing better. So if a small county comes up 2 or 3 percentage points, and all over the state of Pennsylvania, we will have no problem at all electing a Democrat here in Pennsylvania. I think all of the candidates that have come to visit us thus far have been well received. Bernie Sanders has been to Pennsylvania, and Joe Biden has been here. And I just went up to Erie last week and Tim Ryan from Ohio. He's from Youngstown, and he came to Erie, and he was extremely well-received in that Erie County.
How important, quickly, a follow-up about Erie, how important is it to really win back Erie County, because they went, the county as a whole went Republican last presidential.
I know. And when I was there on Thursday night, they said, so we made a mistake. We're not going to make that mistake again. The Erie County Democratic Party is so excited and so motivated. They really brought the numbers up in the last congressional race, but not quite enough to overcome some of the other red counties. But Erie County outperformed what they had done in the presidential election, and they are growing and strong. And I think that Thursday night, that room was just so motivated and so excited about being part of the Erie County Democratic Party. So I know how important Erie is. I think Hillary Clinton did not go to Erie. And that's been a metaphor. We've talked about that, that she did not go to Erie. I think that the next candidate that wins Pennsylvania will have to concentrate and focus on not only southwestern Pennsylvania, but all of our rural areas. And for instance, Hillary was here three times in the last week before the election. She should have been in Johnstown and Altoona and Erie. And I think that we're getting that point across. Our county executive, Rich Fitzgerald, mentioned that recently. And every Democrat that knows this region says the same thing.
Less than a minute left. I want to ask you, how much of your appeal will be to labor, since Donald Trump did quite well among this group that traditionally went to Democrats?
Well, I don't think there's anything more important to the Democratic Party than labor and the influence of labor on our process. We are the Democratic Party. We are the working people of Pennsylvania, and that's our roots. We have not forgotten that, and we're going to be reminding people of that in 2019 and in 2020 to take Pennsylvania from red to blue.
Nancy Patton Mills is the chair of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And tomorrow at this time, we'll be talking with the state Republican chair, Val DiGiorgio. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Drop-in centers can be a powerful tool for people with mental health diagnoses to help one another. Some counties in Pennsylvania don't have any of these programs, and some that do have limited hours and resources. What effect is this having on communities? And the Cary Furnaces serve as a memorial to Big Steel in Pittsburgh, but have also hosted arts events for years. Quantum Theater thought that made the perfect stage for Shakespeare's King Lear, a play about a man who loses everything that defines him, including his family and his power. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Connellsville native Herb Morrison announces the Hindenburg Zeppelin disaster over the radio in 1937.
It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the furniture.
Morrison was working for a Chicago news radio show when he was assigned to cover Hindenburg's arrival in New Jersey. His newscast has often been dubbed over videos of the crash. Morrison would go on to serve during World War II and was the first news director at WTAE-TV here in Pittsburgh. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Gateway Medical Society is an association of doctors, nurses, and non-medical professionals committed to eliminating health disparities among people of color. At an event later this week, the organization will offer free screenings and counseling. 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort talked with GMS Vice President Stephen Evans, a surgical oncologist, about the need for this type of community outreach.
At this year's Gateway to Wellness event, we will really be focusing on how to acquire not only a healthy mind, but how to eat and make healthy choices with our meals, and how to just keep it moving with simple physical activities so that we can be in a position to eliminate these health disparities that arise that affect our communities of color. Chronic illnesses, stress, suicidal ideations, being overweight, they may appear as mountains at first, but at this symposium, both young and old will learn to have tools to go on the journey.
Why is this important to you?
It is important to me because I have been so impacted seeing these chronic illnesses affect my immediate family. Thankfully, my parents lived to be long age, 94 and 98. But unfortunately, my wife did not have that privilege. She succumbed to colon cancer, which is our second most common cause of morbidity and mortality in our community, breast cancer being number one. So it's very personal. And so for me personally, I said, how can I make a difference?
What else is going to be going on?
With our youth symposium, they also, in being so inundated with technology and all these challenges, want to really see how they can overcome the stresses that are so pervasive in their young age. Mm-hmm. Anxiety, depression, and suicide, believe it or not, remain very high within our African-American youth. And so we will have our former national president of the National Association of Medical Illness give a talk to us on that day, and have other professionals talk to our male young men youth about suicide and how to deal with suicidal thoughts, because we want to empower them to be able to control their mind and control stress also through physical activity. So we're going to have dancing, of course, because that's a great release. And it's an exercise activity.
And who is the symposium on May 11th for?
It is for your mothers. It is for our fathers. It is for our community. It is for our youth. It is for anyone who wants to have that gateway to maleness become real to them.
This event is free. It'll be held Saturday, May 11th from 7:30 in the morning to 2 in the afternoon at the UPMC Shadyside Hospital campus on Center Avenue. Dr. Stephen Evans, thank you for taking time to do this interview.
Thank you for having me, Elaine.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The State Department of Human Services says drop-in centers are a powerful resource, allowing people who have a mental health diagnosis to help one another. However, some counties don't have any such programs, while others have limited hours and limited resources. WITF's Brett Schultes looks at the effect one drop-in center is having on a community.
It's just before Easter, and about 35 people are gathered in the basement of Bethany Lutheran Church in Altoona for what feels kind of like a party.
She is the executive director of the Hope Drop-In.
Food, conversation. Some people are painting eggs or making decorations.
Egg coloring.
It's what you might expect at a church, with one exception. Just about every person here has a serious mental illness, like depression, anxiety disorder, or schizophrenia.
Okay, my name is Pamela Townsend. We are in Hope Drop-In Center in Blair County.
People like Pamela.
Hope Drop-In Center is a community support for individuals living with a mental illness or co-occurring illness.
Pam developed major depression and an eating disorder that almost took her life in her 30s. Now 60 years old, she works full-time as a peer support specialist in an area where someone dealing with a mental health issue may face challenges in finding a place to turn.
Transportation has been a huge issue here in Blair County.
She says the drop-in center, which she helped start 5 years ago, is meeting a big need in the community.
It's very laid back. We're not a mental health provider. So they can come here and just hang out for the day.
Pennsylvania Mental Health Consumers Association data shows 11 PA counties don't have any drop-in centers. Most have just one or two, and sometimes they're only open as few as 3 hours a week. The State Department of Human Services touts drop-in centers as a supplement to formal psychological services. Mental health advocates say more counties and cities could learn from similar programs. A few miles down the road at the county's mental health office, Administrator Jim Hudak says the value of the drop-in center can't be overstated.
If you would talk to any of our counterparts across the Commonwealth, what are the challenges in your county? They're going to tell you housing, transportation, employment, and life skills.
Hudak says Blair is like a lot of rural counties across Pennsylvania.
Median income is well below the state's. I want to say our poverty rate is a little bit higher than the state's average. I think our children in poverty is higher.
Like others, Blair County's mental health program was hit hard by the 2012 budget cuts, which slashed his funding by 10%.
As costs still keep on going up, we are reaching that saturation point that dollars aren't going to be there.
But he says the lack of funding isn't the only problem, and more dollars aren't the only solution either.
We can supply the services, but it's the other social determinants that we seem to always be missing.
Hudak says the drop-in center is a great example of how communities can help themselves. And here's the kicker. He says compared to a lot of programs, the whole thing costs very little. Peer specialists like Pam are paid through hiring agencies from a Medicaid reimbursement. The county is chipping in some block grant funds to help buy a building, meaning the drop-in center will eventually move out of the church basement.
The block grant traditionally has been the payer of last resort. When no one else can pay for it, we will pay for it.
But Hudak warns there are threats. If lawmakers were to slash Medicaid, it could cut off funding for peer support workers. And it takes a lot of work from people like Pam, who have made it their full-time job. Pam Townsend is now back at the church, where about 15 people are gathered for art classes as part of a collaboration with an art professor at nearby Mount Aloysius College.
And then he matted and framed it, and it looked pretty amazing.
That's framing.
I know, it is magical.
She says the goal now is to make the drop-in center available 5 days a week instead of two.
The sustainability is what we're looking at right now. We have the money to buy a building.
Her friend Jenny Behe is also a peer specialist.
I was very housebound, had a very small circle that I would travel to.
She says she overcame an anxiety disorder that used to keep her from driving, working, or even really going out in public.
We are to represent the evidence that we have come out of that. I mean, of course, we're still working on ourselves, always.
Now Behe has a job, and she says she has a purpose, helping others.
I worked with elderly peers, and they were desperate for help.
A recent grant program ended, abruptly cutting off an effort that was doing that work. So she says she wants to restart a program that reaches out to older people with depression.
They can't get the things that they really need just to survive, you know, food, whatever, personal items.
As peer specialists Pam Townsend and Jenny Behe are not earning much of a livable wage.
They say they're starting at 12 now, but I think that
when I started,
it
was like 9 or 10.
And I think it was 10 when I started.
But they're employed, and they're helping others in a way that really even a therapist or psychiatrist can't do.
Bye, Dan.
For people like Pam and Jenny, who battle mental illness themselves and continue to fight it every day, being able to help others is a lot more than a job. Through helping others, they're also helping themselves to recover from serious mental illness. In Altoona, Blair County, I'm Brett Schultes.
In just a minute, we continue our look at drop-in centers and challenges for mental health services across the state. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. And we're live with WITF health reporter Brett Schultes to explore mental health services in the Commonwealth. Brett, welcome to The Confluence.
Hey, happy to be here, Kevin.
Thank you so much. Brett, your report that we just heard focused on one drop-in center, care center. Let's take a look at the bigger picture. How available are these centers?
It really just depends on the county, and there are currently 11 counties that don't have any drop-in centers in Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, those are often the same counties that they're rural counties. They may lack a lot of other resources as well. And there are real, you know, distance and just geographical barriers to the people who live there getting quick and easy access to things like drop-in centers, which, you know, really need to be there when they need them, not just a couple hours a week.
And so we're talking about travel issues in addition to accessibility.
Yeah, and these are, you know, these are like pretty basic type problems that even compound the more, you know, nuanced concerns that go along with mental health or behavioral health care. It was interesting talking to Blair County's administrator, and I talked to a lot of county administrators because they're really on the front lines of helping people in their, you know, local communities. And as he says in the story, you know, it's the basic stuff that oftentimes people they're struggling to provide for people, a ride to where you need to go. You know, some of the stuff that didn't even make it into my story was whenever they are able to connect somebody, maybe even somebody with a job, they're kind of in, they're recovering, their mental health condition is under control, and now they're working part-time or full-time, and they may not have easy access to even get to where they need to go. And so, like, simple things like that can really prevent barriers that compound the problems that they already have.
What mental health challenges are we talking about, Brett?
Major or serious mental illnesses like bipolar disorder, major depression, schizophrenia, borderline personality disorder, schizoaffective disorder. You know, anxiety disorder is extremely common and can be, can range from a person who may be able to hold down a job and work to people who absolutely, you know, require a lot of care all the time.
How is the availability or lack of availability of these drop-in centers, how's that affecting mental health care in emergency rooms?
Great question. And drop-in centers are just one little corner of the overall sort of lack of available services in Pennsylvania overall, and it's not just a Pennsylvania problem. People end up in the emergency rooms often because so many things failed before they got to that point. Somebody perhaps wasn't able to get in with a psychiatrist or psychologist because of long wait times, because of complexities with their insurance, or for other reasons. And, you know, then you look at perhaps they weren't available to go to a drop-in center because they were in crisis. And then the next thing you know is that they end up at the emergency room. The idea of the drop-in center, one of the big perks of having a drop-in center in your community is that for somebody who may be having an acute anxiety or some other type of thing that would otherwise get them to go to an emergency room, they can go to that drop-in center, which is a non-clinical environment, and they can just kind of be with people who can provide some help to them at that time. So, and you just think about the money aspect of it. It also is, you know, it's certainly a lot cheaper to go there.
Yeah, emergency rooms are quite expensive no matter what care you're seeking, right?
Oh, absolutely.
You report in your series Through the Cracks on an industry phenomena called psychiatric boarding. Please explain that for us.
Psychiatric boarding is very common, and it's the practice of when somebody goes to or is even taken to an emergency room because they are in crisis. They may be having thoughts or plans of suicide or to hurt someone else. Psychiatric boarding is the practice of keeping them there while they work through that that process. But then the actual term psychiatric boarding is when they stay there because there's nobody, there's nowhere else to take them. So I think the story that you might be referring to was in Lebanon County, where because there's this sort of traffic jam of available beds or available spots for people to get care in things like extended acute care or in a longer term type of care, they just end up kind of waiting at the emergency room. And so much so that some hospitals and emergency rooms have set up special units to do psychiatric boarding. So it's, you know, the emergency rooms have tried to respond to it, but I think most people would agree that the place that you belong if you have a serious mental illness and you're in crisis is not necessarily going to be the emergency room.
So what happens when people don't get the care they need right away? They don't have that immediate care, and they're sort of being backed up.
A lot of things can happen. I mean, typically, if we're talking about the emergency room situation, I think the emergency room does a good job of addressing their needs in the short term, but really where we see the cycle breaking down is that follow-up care. If they've made it to the emergency room, if you're in the emergency room, it's likely that eventually from there you could end up in a sort of residential rehab or another type of inpatient care afterwards. The problem is really kind of after that. A person is left back out into, you know, just free to go in the community. And then it's all those other services where, you know, just being able to go to the psychologist when you need to, having a active, assertive care team who can check in with you. It's really those things that where those areas fall apart, then the person who has a serious mental illness or serious health diagnosis ends up kind of going back through that cycle. And then the next thing you know, they're back in crisis and back in the emergency room again because those other pieces didn't line up.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're speaking with WITF's Brett Schultes about his reporting on mental health care in Pennsylvania. The series is called Through the Cracks, and we'll put a link on our website. Brett, we have just a couple minutes left. Solutions. How are individual counties, medical centers, where you've been reporting, addressing those challenges you've been telling us about?
You know, this is nothing new for the state of Pennsylvania, and I think that there are a lot of different interests trying to make changes happen. Just the fundamental, one of the biggest things to know about this and the sort of backdrop to a lot of what's happening now is that funding hasn't really increased in a meaningful way in about two decades. And it actually, very specifically, funding for, without getting into too many details of how it works, but one of the biggest funding streams decreased by 10% in 2012 because then Governor Tom Corbett made budget cuts. And so if you talk to any of the county administrators, they just had to find things that they had to cut. It would just be like, you know, not that it's a business, but like with a business, you'd have to cut services. So I think there's a push to try to get more funding. At the same time, we're seeing major changes or potential changes in the way that services through Medicaid would be administered in Pennsylvania. There are two bills in the House and Senate right now that would merge together the behavioral health side of Medicaid with the physical health side. And that's just going to sound like a bunch of, you know, if you're not familiar with how Medicaid works, it's kind of complicated. But the bottom line with that is those deep structural changes are going to have some effects as well, I think.
All right. And Medicaid can only cover so much. Brett, final question for you. So what else are you looking, you and your team, and future reporting on mental health care in Pennsylvania?
Well, there are a lot more things to look at right now. I think in Pennsylvania also we have a system where residential mental health services are provided by companies or nonprofits. And so I want to know why we have such long wait times and so many people are going without care or waiting so many months. Because on some level, I mean, I understand that those companies and nonprofits need to be paid for their services. But at the same time, we have a system where it used to be administered by the state hospitals. We have moved away from that. Now we outsource that care to companies. So that's great. But if that's their job, then some of them need, we need to ask the question of why they aren't able to provide enough services for the people who need them, because that's now on those companies to do that work. And if we have counties and parts of the state where people are waiting months to get into residential rehab and they're stuck staying with families or staying, mm-hmm. you know, in emergency rooms. So I think that's a big part of it as well. We want to look at why those long wait times are there.
Well, Brett, we look forward to your reporting. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Brett Schultes is WITF's health reporter. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Shakespeare's works have been staged indoors and outdoors in theaters, large and small, in high school auditoriums and in parks. But Pittsburgh's Quantum Theater opted for a grander stage. King Lear opens May 10th on the site of a former steel mill, the Cary Blast Furnaces in Swissvale. WESA's arts and culture reporter Bill O'Driscoll is in studio with us to talk about that. Bill, first off, remind us briefly about the story of King Lear.
Right. This is about a king in roughly medieval times who is getting older, and he decides to divide his kingdom among his three daughters, but it doesn't work out so well. Tragedy ensues.
Okay. So Quantum Theater, known for its presentations of different plays, various locations, and some more unique styles, is it not?
Right. They do site-specific work. That's why the theater company was founded probably close to 30 years ago now by Carla Boos.
Okay. The classic Shakespearean tale is being presented at the Cary Blast Furnaces, National Historic Landmark, Swissvale. So why a steel mill, and why this one?
Well, why this one is because simply it's one of the last remnants of the Homestead Works, one of the last sites of Pittsburgh's historic steel heritage. This is run by the Rivers of Steel Heritage Corporation. It's a national landmark. Why that appeals is the director, Richard Reddick, told me that he feels like it's Pittsburgh lost its identity when it lost Big Steel. Lear loses his identity. Pittsburgh was on a sort of journey to find out what it was. In the absence of Big Steel, something similar, very similar, happens to Lear.
So is it self-discovery? Is it reinventing oneself? What?
Reinventing might be a little too new agey and kind of optimistic of a term for what happens in King Lear. It's sort of about learning about himself, learning about who he really is and the reality of his life he had been blind to before. The tragedy, of course, is that he learns it too late to really help himself.
I understand that this setting is very important to one of the lead actors. How so?
Sure. Jeff Carpenter of Bricolage Production Company plays King Lear in this play. And he, some 20 years ago, folks might know a little bit of the history. There was a lot of guerrilla artwork that was done on the Cary Blast Furnaces site after it closed down in the early 80s. In the 90s, there was a group of artists called the Industrial Artists Co-op who went there and made artworks on the site without permission. Jeff was one of the folks who went there sometimes to do that. Now he's playing King Lear there.
Will some of that iconic artwork be featured in this production?
Yes, very much so. The one folks will know is the Cary Deer, which is a...
Oh, yeah.
Two-story tall deer head made out of wire, all found on the site, fabricated over a period of years, really, by these artists. And it's quite something if you haven't seen it. And that'll be a backdrop for the first three acts of the play.
Mm-hmm. Cary Furnace, part of the old Homestead Steelworks. It's been used for years now for arts events, weddings, films, more. Just another incarnation?
Yeah, this is a new thing for it to have really a theatrical production of this scale. The Rivers of Steel National Heritage Corporation has really opened up the site. They do interpretive things there that are about the history of the steel industry. They have tours and things like that. But they've also opened it up to lots of other kinds of events, lots of arts events, and they want to keep doing that. So this is the next thing.
A couple of minutes ago, you told us briefly, you know, the synopsis of the story of King Lear. So Shakespeare's plays are often moved to different time periods. Will that be the case with Quantum Theater's King Lear?
Not really. I don't think. I mean, often, you know, Lear doesn't, it's not really a historical tale exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like Julius Caesar or something like that. So you can play with it a lot more easily than with some of these other plays of Shakespeare's, and I think they're going to incorporate contemporary elements. There'll be elements suggestive of sort of medieval times, but it's sort of a timeless kind of a setting that they're going for.
All right. We have just a few seconds left, so I have to ask you, as arts and culture reporter, will you be in attendance? And if so, what are you most looking forward to about this performance?
Yeah, I certainly hope to see the show. It sounds pretty spectacular. It's a great play. It's got a great cast. I think, Jeff Carpenter, Tammy Dixon of Bricolage Productions, also a number of other great local actors are in it. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. And, of course, just the setting. It's going to be really something to see.
Bill O'Driscoll is WESA's arts and culture reporter. King Lear runs May 10th to June 2nd. You can find out more at WESA.FM. Bill, thanks so much for making the time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the Democrats racked up victories in 2018 in federal and state elections following the surprise victory by Donald Trump in Pennsylvania in 2016. We'll talk with the state Republican chair Val DiGiorgio about how President Trump has to hold on to Pennsylvania in 2020. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, assistance by Joe Yazenkovich and Meg Fair. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.